battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to be reminded of the views that are expressed here and not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And you can go ahead and put in a call, because right now we don't know whether we're going to have a guest or not. It's supposed to be a good friend, William Federer, but apparently there's having a little difficulty getting in touch with him. So if you'd like to call in, fill in until he gets here. Our telephone number, again, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But I was just thinking, you know, it was Colonel Nasser who ruled Egypt from about 1953 to 1971, who wrote a letter to President John Kennedy, and he said in that, you know, the genius of you Americans is that you never make simple, stupid mistakes. You consistently make complex, stupid mistakes, which always leaves us wondering if we're missing something. And I would like to suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that we do not make either simple, stupid mistakes or complicated, stupid mistakes. We do a lot of things that really don't make any sense, but they are not mistakes. The people in charge know exactly what they're doing. For instance, I mean, when we, of course, had taken Iraq after first lying to the American people about the weapons of mass destruction, and they were a threat to us, and the truth of the matter is, there really were weapons of mass destruction, and they've been transferred to Syria, and they're buried in tunnels there, and our government knows it, and the Israelis know it, and the Syrians know it, and the Iranians know it. Everybody knows it except the American people. But be that as it may, so we are victorious. I mean, we attacked about the middle of March, by the 1st of May, the year 2003, while we had secured Iraq pretty well. And it was that time, of course, the president, you remember, of course, in his flight suit, and I don't know why he bothered to wear a flight suit, other than to try to give you the idea that he was a pilot during the Vietnam War. Well, of course, nobody ever fined him for doing the flying he was supposed to be doing. He was in the National Guard that didn't show up there. He wasn't going to risk his life riding for something he knew was a fraud. But under any circumstances, he gets into a flight suit. He lands on the flight deck. Well, he doesn't really land. He's in the plane when it lands. But to give you the impression that he's been piloting this plane and setting it down on the carrier deck, and then he announces that the war is over. We've won. We've won in Baghdad. And of course, the truth of the matter is, we had won. But of course, we were going to do everything we could to destabilize the country. So the first thing they did was send Paul Bremer over as the presidential envoy. And he arrived about the 2nd or 3rd of May and immediately disbanded the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police, the Iraqi civil service. So there was just no basis for law and order. There was just total devastation. There was just total chaos. And that meant that we had to stay on. And then, of course, what we should have done was organize the Iraqi army. But they refused to organize the Iraqi army. Oh, they made a great fuss about how we were going to organize an Iraqi army so they could take over. Ladies and gentlemen, it's over 3 years later, and still the Iraqi army has not been organized. And why? Because we never intended to organize the Iraqi army. The Major General Paul Evans, as I remember, he was the gentleman, we quote him in one of our newsletters, who was assigned the job of organizing the Iraqi army. He was promised a force of men and all the equipment he needed, and they never gave him any men. I think he had 25 men, and he said, I was supposed to organize an army for a nation of 25 million people with 25 men. And he was supposed to have had all the equipment, and he said we didn't have it. We didn't have a cadre. He said we couldn't even use some of the people from the Iraqi army as non-commissioned officers to begin to train an army. He said trying to organize an army without non-commissioned officers due to the training is like trying to put up a tent without tent posts. You can't do it. And that's covered in some of our newsletters. You have to understand that to this very day, we're not supplying the Iraqi army with adequate weapons. We're not supplying with adequate food. And a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, of all places, was simply saying that But well, that's something we find ourselves. We actually have gone over to KKMC, and so we want to tell you that we're waiting for our regularly scheduled guest, and he hasn't shown up. So if you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And I'm still working to have open lines, I guess, for this hour. And give us a call if you'd like to. And I was simply going to the background of how we've created the chaos there in Iraq. And we've done it intentionally. I pointed out that certainly after we'd won the war, all we had to do was turn it over to the military until they could have their elections. On elections, we did not want a solution, because if you had stability in Iraq, how could we justify keeping our troops there indefinitely? So they dissolved, of course, the military, they dissolved the police, they dissolved the civil service, and you have chaos. And then, of course, instead of organizing an Iraqi army, why, they specifically did not organize an Iraqi army. Well, they kept talking about it. Oh, we're trying so hard, but we just can't get it going. The units, when we put them in the field, they won't fight. Well, they didn't give them the equipment, they didn't give them the training, they didn't give them the protection, they didn't give them the armored personnel carriers that such as we had. They didn't give them anything they really needed, of course, to fight effectively within the last 2 weeks. Well, one of the seven provinces has been turned over to the local militia there, and they're supposed to maintain law and order and fight off the insurgents. And you saw pictures of them in the New York Times. And what are they holding in their hands? Why, they're holding rifles, bolt-action rifles, that date back to World War I. That's what we're arming. The militias over there, they're going to maintain law and order. And then we wonder why they don't want to fight people who have automatic weapons and these explosive devices and grenades and howitzers and all the weapons of warfare that the insurgents have. And we're not giving adequate support to the Iraqi army, because if the Iraqi army could take over, how would we be able to maintain our troops there? How would we maintain this total chaos that's there as the country deteriorates into civil war? And as long as there's instability in Iraq, we can justify we've just got to stay. We can't cut and run and leave you in a state of chaos. We're here to help you. Ladies and gentlemen, we've created the chaos to justify staying in Iraq. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and what we're saying, of course, talking about the chaos that we have created in Iraq, and now the same thing is happening in Afghanistan, and the whole country is beginning to implode, and now the Taliban is reforming in Afghanistan and selectively coming in and attacking towns. Where is the Taliban reforming? Why, they're reforming themselves and the new military units in Pakistan. And who's giving, about $1 billion or so every year to Pakistan? Why, we are. In other words, we're financing the people who are allowing the Taliban to organize within their borders to attack our forces in Afghanistan. That really doesn't make sense. But, of course, as General Nasser had said, or Colonel Nasser had said, when he wrote that letter many years ago to President Kennedy, the genius of you Americans is you always seem to make, you never make simple, stupid mistakes. You always make complicated, stupid mistakes, which always leaves us wondering if we're missing something. I would like to suggest that anybody who looks at what's going on in Iraq would have to realize that we could not have done such a poor job. And actually, the military wanted far more troops. Donald Rumsfeld wouldn't give those troops. The military, of course, wanted to turn control of Iraq over to the Iraqis, And many of these people hated Saddam Hussein, but they were forced to back him. Either that or they would be tortured to death, and their families would be tortured to death. And, of course, anybody who's ever read that book we carry entitled See No Evil, it's written by Robert Baer. And Robert Baer was a CIA agent operating in Iraq during the 1990s, and he says that he never met an Iraqi who did not believe the United States government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power, and cited at least two instances when the Iraqi military wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And on both occasions, military officers were betrayed by our own State Department. Why would we do something that stupid? I don't think it was stupid at all. I believe everything is going by a timetable to bring us to the situation we're in at the present time. which was soon going to deteriorate into a war with Iran. Whether it's going to be now or a few years from now, I don't know, but I fear it may be now, the way things are going, because what's going on in the Middle East, in opposition to the Middle East, what's going on certainly in Israel, I wonder how many people out there listening on it honestly believe that the United States, pardon me, that Israel, went to war with Hezbollah and began attacking Lebanon and blowing up, you know, whole districts of that city because that two of their soldiers had been kidnapped. Well, one in the south and two in the north. Those of you who heard my interviews with Barry Shamus, well, he will tell you that those men were intentionally turned over to Hezbollah. They were intentionally turned over by their Israeli government. They wanted an excuse to go to war. That's a terrible thing to say, but here's Barry Shamus, who I believe is a Jewish patriot, who has spent a great deal of time over in Israel, and only recently came to America because he was afraid that his life was endangered. And Barry Shamus says he's talked to people, he's read the records, and everything points to the fact that certainly with the soldier who was kidnapped in the south, the military was prevented from trying to rescue him. His compatriots, his fellow soldiers, wanted to rescue him, and they weren't allowed to try to rescue him. Why would that be? And in the north, of course, the two soldiers were left in tanks, completely unguarded. Why would you do something that foolish unintentionally? Well, the telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our regularly scheduled guest is not here, and so we hope that you'll give us a call and we can talk about what you'd like to talk about, or we can talk about the tragedy that is unfolding in the Middle East. And apparently now about 400 civilians, Lebanese civilians, have been killed. Probably 1,000 or 1,500 have been seriously wounded, but you have over 750,000 Lebanese who are now simply exiles in their own country. They're refugees. They're fleeing. They're trying to get into Syria. Many of them have lost their homes, their savings, their businesses. Their lives are destroyed. And what is their crime? They've committed no crime at all. Prior to this, many of them, I'm sure, were very, very sympathetic to Israel. But, of course, the policies that are being enacted today are specifically designed to turn the entire Middle East and Near East against Israel. And, of course, I think this is preparation for the great war that's coming in that area. It's only a matter of time. If you go into Egypt today, of course, the radical form of Islam, which really didn't exist until, well, it really didn't exist until we began to create it, until it was being funded by the American Central Intelligence Agency starting about 1980. And if you doubt what I'm telling you, the devil's game that really goes into the background of this radical Islamic movement, starting, of course, with the Muslim Brotherhood, but that didn't start until 1928. It was really marked in the 1870s when the British intelligence, the MI5 and MI6, became funding of this radical form of Islam, a resurgence of the radical form of Islam, which had really been latent for many, many centuries, this form of conquering by the sword, which Muhammad had advocated, which most Muslims had rejected by 1870. But the British intelligence began funding that. There was a man named Afghani, who was actually a Persian. He wasn't really from Afghanistan, but he called himself Afghani, so he could be unraveling the as he called for this radical form of Islam. And then two generations later, why, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood is created in Egypt, and it is funded by British intelligence. British intelligence keeps on funding this until America eclipses following the Second World War, and then the Central Intelligence Agency is funding this radical form of Islam. And if you doubt that, we have a newspaper article comes out of the Washington Post, of all places, talking about how we were actually spent $51 million to buy textbooks that are to be used in the schools in Afghanistan for the school children, encouraging this radical form of Islam. And many of those young people who were indoctrinated with your tax dollars in the 1980s became the Taliban fighters of the 1990s and the year 2000. And, of course, the difficulty is that the American government financed the Taliban. Remember, we were the largest source of humanitarian aid for the Taliban, you know, right up until September 11th. And if you doubt that, and I hope you will challenge me, I hope you'll go to the website whitehouse.gov. That's whitehouse.gov, and read the article, it is the speech that President Bush gave on the 20th September. That's 9 days after the 9/11 attack. And there he says, you know, the United States is the largest source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan. Well, since Bush got called by the Taliban, we were the largest source of humanitarian aid for the Taliban, and we were supporting the Taliban, and we had supported them for many years, and they were the people who were hosting the work of Osama bin Laden. What's wrong with this picture? We carried a book for some time called Missing Bin Laden, pointed out there were 11 separate times we could have captured Osama bin Laden, and the Central Intelligence Agency consistently refused to capture him before 9/11, and we certainly haven't been trying very hard to catch him since then, have we? How could it possibly be that we have satellites that can read, you know, can read a newspaper from outer space that we just can't find Osama bin Laden, and we can, of course, we can watch both day and night? We're told he's hiding in a cave. Is he really hiding in a cave? Are we really trying to catch Osama bin Laden? Well, let's go to Mike calling from New York. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Troubled, actually.
Why are you troubled?
Well, you know, I became a Christian in 2001. And people that have made an impression upon my life are folks that have been Christians for 15, 20 years. And I feel like I'm in a twilight zone because this aspect of what's going on over there, especially with, you know, Israel. The sentiment around here is go Israel, go. You know, defend her and everything that she's doing. She can do no harm, no atrocity, no... You know, I talk to these people and I say, I thought we were under like a different gospel. You know, shouldn't we be feeling compassion, you know, for children and families being torn apart in Lebanon? And everybody agreed that the government there was not in any shape or form able to rein in Hezbollah in the first place. You know, the world did nothing to try to put constraints on Lebanon to do that at all. And, you know, two soldiers get captured. It's happened before, and I'm not saying that, you know, their lives are any less important, but...
Well, I think that you have to recognize, Mike, that the two soldiers were simply the excuse that was used.
Yes, I
do. It had nothing to do with those soldiers.
You know, but what they're trying to feed the world is, you know, they're coming under attack by Hezbollah. And my biggest problem is... You know, the Christians that I've come in contact with, they're all about, well, you know, the more problems over there, the more wars, you know, ratchet up over there, all the better. Means the end of the world and the rapture, and I could think it's...
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and the idea that, you know, we're suddenly going to be whisked away here before anything bad happens to us really is crass indifference to the suffering of others. And I think that one of the big problems is we do not have adequate Christian leadership, and I belong to their organizations, and I will tell you that they have all been compromised, and so much of the Christian media and has been compromised by people who are misleading the Christians of this country. Certainly, what is happening over in the Middle East and in the Near East is a great tragedy, but the Israeli government is being manipulated by people within Washington, D.C., and certainly the people in Lebanon are being manipulated. Both sides are being manipulated. What is really going on is a war between the United States and Iran. And, of course, we're using proxies to fight that war. Well, we understand that it all makes sense. But you're absolutely right. The war has nothing to do with those two soldiers. I fear that this is just a prelude to something that is really very, very serious. Why don't you hang on here? We'll take your call in just a moment, okay?
Yep.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to let you go. We apparently have our regularly scheduled guest. I know how you feel, and just keep your eyes on the Lord. Understand this is all being manipulated.
Yeah, Okay, you take care of that.
Thanks so much.
You too. Yep.
Okay, fine. And I apologize to those people that we have hanging on the line, but we do have Bill Federer, certainly one of my favorite guests. And there was an important subject I wanted to talk to him about, so Bill will be with us in just a moment. But apropos of what Mike is saying, understand it has nothing to do with the two soldiers. That is simply the excuse that is being used to justify going in over there. And understand this is not a battle between Israel and Hezbollah, because Israel is backed completely by the United States. Hezbollah is backed and financed by Iran. But then the next question is, where does Iran get their backing? Oh, we're told they have a lot of money. But they're a relatively small country. They may be three times the size of Iraq, but they do not have the industrial base, you know, that certainly they would need to take on America in a battle. No, they're being backed by communist China. They're being backed by Russia. But who is it who's backing and financing communist China and Russia? Well, you know, one of the corporations, one of the financial institutions that has done more to help and build up communist China is Goldman Sachs. And Goldman Sachs has invested literally billions of dollars in Chinese banks and Chinese industry, and has built up communist China, their industrial and military potential. And the president of Goldman Sachs recently gave up his $40 million a year job. His name is Paulson. And Mr. Paulson gave up a $40 million a year job to become the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States at $180,000 a day. Now, there's a real patriot, or maybe nothing as it appears to be. And, Chris, let me suggest to you that until you understand that there are forces working behind the scenes, what I believe is dark spiritual forces that are moving and preparing to plunge us into a major war in the Middle East, and it's coming a lot sooner than you think, why nothing really makes sense. Well, that is the background. Let's go to our special guest this afternoon, William Federer. Hi, William. How are you doing?
Hello, Dr. Stan. Great to be with you.
Okay, fine. Well, we were going to talk about a different subject. We were going to talk about the colonial times. We were going to talk about people like Thomas Jefferson and his rather complex life. And really, of course, he had some very, very difficult times I don't think most people really know about.
No, Thomas Jefferson is an interesting person. He was an Anglican. Because the Church of England was the official church for Virginia. From the founding of Virginia, the first charter in 1606, all the way up into 1786, the Church of England was the established church for Virginia. It's interesting, you read the original three charters, 1606, 1607, 1609, it says in there that no member of the Church of Rome shall ever be allowed in the colony. the Catholics, they wouldn't allow Puritans. They chase out the Puritans and the Lutherans. And so that is when a church was established as such, it was mandatory membership, mandatory taxes to support the denomination. The king's government chose the pastors for each parish. And so Thomas Jefferson was a faithful member of St. Anne's Episcopal, Anglican Church there in Albemarle County, Virginia. And he actually...
Hold that thought, will you? We'll be back in just a moment with William Federer. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon is William Federer, and we're so glad to get him on with us. We were talking about Thomas Jefferson, who, of course, was raised in Virginia. He was a member of the Anglican Church, which was the government denomination there in Virginia. Virginia legislature, of course, I guess it was the king before the... time of the Revolution, the king appointed the ministers, and everything was really controlled through the state, and no other religion was allowed other than the Anglican religion in the state of Virginia. And I'm sure Thomas Jefferson and many thinking people thought that was wrong. So you pick up the struggle.
And most people don't understand at the time, in Europe, and I've mentioned it several times, they had this philosophy that whatever the king believed, the kingdom had to believe. And again, if you were in England, you were expected to be Anglican. Now, they did have dissenters, and the dissenters, were like Quakers and Mennonites and so forth. In the German countries, it was mostly Lutheran. In Switzerland, it was Calvinist.
in Italy, Spain, France, and Austria, it was Roman Catholic. Greece and Russia was Eastern Orthodox. Scotland was Presbyterian. Holland was Dutch Reformed. Sweden was Swedish Lutheran. You get the picture. It was each country had its own denomination. And so when the colonies were started in America, each colony had its own denomination. Originally, Virginia and North and South Carolina were Church of England. Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire were Congregationalist, Puritan. New York was Dutch Reformed, and then when the British took over, they tried to enforce with different, degrees of effort the Anglican Church over the inhabitants there in the, the former Dutch colony of New Amsterdam. Maryland was originally a Catholic colony. They let any Christian hold office, and more Protestants got elected than them and voted the Catholics out of office. And then the Church of England tried to come in and be the chosen Protestant denomination. Georgia, their charter allowed any Protestant to hold office, and then the Church of England tried to enforce theirs as the only denomination. And New Jersey was Swedish Lutheran and Quaker, and then, of course, the Church of England tried to take over. Pennsylvania was unique. It was Pennsylvania and Delaware were basically the same colony for most of the history. They allowed any Christian to hold office, and any citizen who acknowledged Almighty God was allowed equal religious and civil privileges. And so that's why Pennsylvania was so tolerant. It allowed Mennonites and Schweckenfelders and Dunkers, who were German Baptists, and every type of Protestant denomination. 1733, Pennsylvania allowed the first Catholic church in the English-speaking world. When the Reformation happened, with Henry VIII turning the Church of England away from the Catholic Church to the Church of England, every English-speaking country in the world, it was illegal to be a Catholic. And so it wasn't until Philadelphia in 1733 that St. Joseph's Church was founded. It was the first Catholic church in the English-speaking world. And then finally in 1782, or well after the Revolution, the first synagogue was allowed in Philadelphia. New York had had a previous synagogue as of 1730. When the first Jews landed in 1654, but they weren't allowed to have a synagogue building until 1730. But you get the idea of where the country was coming from, and then the most freest was Rhode Island. Rhode Island was founded by Baptists, and they had the doctrine, the understanding that true conversion is from the inside out, not forced by the government from the outside in. And so being as such, believing and being born again, they didn't want the government to require people to be Christian to hold office, because they thought that it would just produce hypocrites, people wanting to hold office that really weren't Christian but would pretend to be Christian because they wanted to hold office. William Penn summed it up well. He said, "Force makes hypocrites, 'tis persuasion only that makes converts." And so here, one of the most religious colonies, religious motivations of Rhode Island, and they didn't allow anybody to have to belong to a particular faith to hold office. This gives a little idea of the setting. Around the time of the Revolution, when we broke away from the King of England, it only makes sense that we break away from the Church of England. And so many of the states began this effort to disestablish the Church of England, and then we pick up with Thomas Jefferson and how he led that effort to disestablish in the state of Virginia.
Now, we're going to be back here in just a couple of minutes with William Federer, and of course we carry William's book, The America's God and Country. We carry a number of his other books. You can get our catalog and go through them. He's done some tremendous writings. But it's so important to understand the religious foundation of America, to understand where we are today and where we are going in the future. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon, William Federer. And you were telling us now that, of course, they, after the revolution, we know that Thomas Jefferson really didn't approve of this, these ideas of a state religion. And so he actually wrote the Bill of Rights for Virginia, didn't he? Where they, of course, would do away with the government church. Pick of the story there.
We were having the revolution, the Anglican churches were not speaking out against the king, obviously because he was the head of their denomination. And so people in America got frustrated, and especially in Virginia, and so they began to leave. And there were churches called dissenting churches that began to spring up. In Scotland, they had revivals, open-air communions is what they called them. It spread to the Welsh in England, and they had open-air meetings. And then, with the help of George Whitefield, they began to spread in America, and they got the termed camp meeting. And so these camp meetings began to take place in the rural areas. And so in Albemarle County, which is where Thomas Jefferson lived, they had more camp meeting revivals than any other county in Virginia. It was amazing when you look at the Baptists moved in there, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, who had been members of the Anglican Church during the lifetime of Charles Wesley, and then finally under Francis Asbury, the Methodists split away unto their own denomination, and they began to move into the area of Virginia. And Thomas Jefferson was, before this period, Thomas Jefferson joined the vestry at St. Anne's Anglican Parish in Virginia prior to the Revolutionary War. The vestry is like the deacons. And they chose as their pastor Charles Clay, who was a cousin of Henry Clay. Now, Charles Clay was an evangelical preacher. Many of his sermons have survived, and they are very evangelical, calling for decisions for Christ and so forth. He's somebody that Thomas Jefferson chose to be the pastor. When the country broke from England, Thomas Jefferson came up with this idea of a voluntary church. In other words, instead of the government forcibly collecting taxes from the populace.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is William Federer. He's saying that after the American Revolution, here in Virginia, of course, it had a state church up until that time, but after the American Revolution, Thomas Jefferson began talking about a voluntary church, not one that was financed by the government, or by the state government, but the one was, of course, where people could go on their own. They could establish their own religion, and they would pay for the pastors themselves. He would not be appointed by the king or by the temporal authority of the government. So pick up the story, Bill.
So in the late 1770s, 76, that era, Thomas Jefferson was one of three founding members of the Calvinistical Reformed Church.
But of course, he was never really, in his heart, he was never really a Calvinist, was he?
He went through a evolution, as many of those founders did. And so if you take any particular snapshot of his life, he can be a different thing. He wrote the founding document for this voluntary church called the Calvinistical Reformed Church. It met in Albemarle County Courthouse. And it... in the founding documents talked about the different members signing up for subscriptions and would set aside a warden once a year to collect the subscriptions from the members to support it. And Jefferson, in his memorandum, his checkbook, writes checks in support of Charles Clay to support this work. Jefferson also supported his St. Anne's Church, which was the required one, and he supported Fredericksville, a church there as well. So three different churches he was supporting out of his checkbook. It's interesting, you look and you see a number quite a number of checks to missionaries and to missionary efforts to evangelize the Indians. Jefferson saw that as a way to reduce the violence on the frontiers was to Christianize and civilize the Indians. So Jefferson helped form this Calvinistical Reformed Church during and was a member there during the Revolutionary period. And then he had six children, and one died, and then two died, and three died, and four died. And then around the time when the fourth one died, his wife died. So we're talking about 1784, right around there, is when his wife died.
Now, this is after he's come back from being the ambassador to Great Britain. Ambassador to France.
No, this is right before.
Okay.
So his wife dies right before he's chosen to go to France. And when his wife died, he had two daughters that lived into adulthood. And one of them, who was last name Epps, E-P-P-E-S, she actually attended crusades. And there's a record of Lorenzo Dow, a Baptist minister who preached crusades in that area. And the daughter attended his crusades. And blacks would attend, you know, as well as whites. Jefferson had many of the Baptists and Methodists and Anglican preachers in his house. And said that he considered the Baptist form of government, the congregational, you know, a purest form of democracy, you know, where the church members vote for the pastors and there's an equal vote and so on and so forth. And Madison had the same. Madison actually had preachers in his house and preached revivals on their property. And so Jefferson and Madison saw themselves as championing the efforts of these dissenting churches by wanting to give them freedom, and the enemy was, of course, the established Anglican church that had the forced dues that you had to pay, and the milk toast. I mean, only one tenth of the pastors in the Anglican churches were on fire, were evangelical. 90% of them, I mean, it was a government appointed position. What's the, you know, there wasn't any fire in their belly to try to, you know, spread the gospel, so to speak, and so Jefferson and Madison saw themselves as championing the efforts of these dissenting churches against the established Church of England. And again, one of Jefferson's friends was Henry Fry. Henry Fry was a member of the Virginia House of Burgesses with Jefferson during the Stamp Act crisis. This guy, I mean, he was a legislator. He was an alcoholic. And he converted and became a Methodist and left his alcoholism and was so on fire for the Lord, he became a preacher. Henry Fry was a famous preacher, and certainly Jefferson knew about it because he was his neighbor, and Henry Fry preached all through that area. There was a Baptist town, and they fasted and prayed that God would close down a distillery, and a lightning struck and burnt the distillery, and then they bought the land and built the church there. I mean, amazing stories that took place in Jefferson's county, Albemarle County, Virginia. John Leland was a Baptist preacher there who became a good friend of Jefferson's.
Well, of course, Jefferson wrote the Jefferson Bible. Now, this, in which he took out all of the miraculous, all of the supernatural. When did he write that?
Now, that was written later, when he was president, and he was friends with the Lewis and Clark. William Clark family and the Meriwether Lewis family were right there in Virginia, in the neighboring county. And so they had family members that were really close to Jefferson. That's why Jefferson chose them. Jefferson wanted to not only evangelize the Indians, but to Christianize them. And he put together a book of the Christian ethics and went through the Bible. He even talked about how he did it. He said he had a couple different versions, a couple different editions of the Bible, and took a penknife and cut out all the teachings of Jesus. And the reason, in his estimation, why he didn't give them the whole Bible is because he didn't want to give them things that were beyond their ability to comprehend. And you know, certainly not the Old Testament, because you know David went battles against the Philistines, and he didn't want these. He wanted them to become peaceful. Now, you and I would have just preferred that he gave them the New Testament rather than doing his little doctrine, but he did it and gave it to printers and was hoping that the printers would have it done by the time Lewis and Clark left. They weren't done in time, but it became a book of ethics, and he considered it proof of his Christianity. Many times he would say that he preferred the doctrines of Jesus above any other doctrines of any other religious teachers. Now, was he born again? Probably not. But
I have so many of his writings where he talks about Christianity, and he believed in Christ, but only the things that he said of himself, and he made no claim for any others, inferring that, of course, he did not claim to be God, which is, of course, totally contrary to what the book of John tells us.
Right, and so on. But jumping back into his life, when his wife died, one of his older daughters that lived into adulthood would write about how he was so distraught, and he'd go around their property and ride out in his wagon into the countryside and just break out and bawl and cry. And he burnt every one of his love letters to his wife, would read through them and then put it on fire in a trash can so there's no record of them. Like, John Adams and his wife Abigail, we have all those letters. He basically became so despondent that he dropped out of the Virginia legislature and didn't even show up. And many friends, offered him positions in the government. This is 16...
this would be 17...
1784.
Right.
And so they went to the U.S. Congress under the Articles of Confederation. This was before the U.S. Constitution was written, but it was after the Declaration. They offered to have Jefferson be ambassador to France along with John Abigail Adams and their children, and John Quincy Adams. And so they were over in France at the same time, and they were very good friends. And of course, Jefferson was a widower, and John Quincy Adams would write about how Jefferson's condo basically was in Paris, where they had a home that was in a suburb of Paris, and so they would always be stopping in on Jefferson, and he was so kind, and I mean, just a neat period of time for him. Anyway, then Adams was chosen as ambassador to England, and so he left and then came back to the United States. And Adams was chosen. Back then, they voted on the president. The person that got the most votes was the president. The person that got the second most votes was vice president. So twice, John Adams was chosen to be vice president. He got second number of votes next to George Washington. Very popular. But it was during this time that Jefferson was alone in France, that they were leading up to their bloody French Revolution. They hadn't gotten there yet, but the thoughts of Rousseau and the, basically the New Age, type of humanist, Unitarian, Universalist, all those different type of thoughts were spreading around France. And the idea was that, we were rebelling against the king, and the people in France were wanting to rebel against, their king, and the king was the head of the Anglican Church, so we were rebelling against the Anglican Church. And then for the founders, it wasn't but an easy step to say, well, we rebelled against the Catholic Church earlier with the Reformation, and so many decided they were going to rebel against all organized churches. Ben Franklin would say things like, whoever shall introduce primitive Christianity shall change the face of the world. And so there was this idea of primitive, just the teachings of Christ, not all the hierarchy and clergy, and that's bad. And so the movement, that Thomas Paine was a part of was to rebel against any organized religion. Then he took it to the next step and says, well, let's rebel against, Christianity, and none of us rebel against God, and then this just got carried away. And of course, our founders in America were appalled by this, but this type of thought was rampant in France, and it gave birth to Robespierre, who was this politically correct enforcer that later ordered 30,000 people that had their heads cut off with a guillotine in the bloody French Revolution, and then Napoleon took over after that. I mean, France has gone through a dozen different forms of government in the same period America has had only one. But anyway, Jefferson was there prior to the French Revolution, but during the time when all these thoughts were going around. Here he had been depressed and discouraged. Four of his six children had died. His wife had died. and he's over there hearing all these different thoughts. And so you can sort of see a marked change in his theology from that point on, and he becomes more of, one of his grandsons or whatever described him as a liberal Anglican or conservative Unitarian. Well, he attended church. He came back and was Secretary of State for George Washington while Adams was the Vice President. That's when Jefferson and Adams had a falling out, and basically Jefferson wanted a weak central government, Adams wanted a strong central government. When they had the election for the second president, Adams won, but Thomas Jefferson got the second most amount of votes, so he was vice president. But his whole 4 years, his people, and as well as his leaning to it, did nothing but undermine John Adams and plotted to win the election. So John Adams did not win a second term, which was the first time somebody that was a president wanting to run for re-election didn't get reelected. Mexico has gone through over 150 years of whenever that happens, they have a bloody coup. But Adams, instead of saying, no, I demand a recount or this or that, he packed up and left. He was offended. He didn't even stay in town for Jefferson's inauguration. Later in life, they patched it up, and they eventually died on the same day, July 4th of 1826. But Jefferson's there as the president, and he gets a letter from the Danbury Baptists in Connecticut. Connecticut still had the established congregational denomination up until 1818. Mandatory taxes, mandatory membership, but Connecticut thought it was being generous by allowing dissenting churches. If you were a member of a dissenting church, you could get a letter signed by your pastor, and you could file it with the courthouse, and your taxes would be forwarded to your church. Then the congregational church began to lose membership, and they made it harder to opt out, and they said you had to get two civil magistrates, beginning 1791, two civil magistrates to sign your certificate of opting out of the congregational church. And that's the setting of which the Danbury Baptists wrote the letter to Thomas Jefferson, and they said they noticed how in Virginia he had championed the cause of the Baptists and Presbyterians and Methodists against the established English church, and so they were basically appealing to him to lend his influence in their situation of the Baptists in congregationalist controlled Massachusetts. In that letter, it's interesting, they write to Jefferson and they say, "We realize that you are not the national legislator and you have no power to destroy the laws of the state, but in your position as president, your genial disposition can shine forth as the rays of the sun, and hopefully have a benign influence on the rest of the country and hopefully change the situation around so we won't be, having to get letters to be a dissenting church." Anyway, Jefferson writes back and he says, "I believe with you that religion is something between man and his God, that the legislative powers of government reach to actions only and not to opinions," which means Jefferson would be against hate crime legislation. He says, "because there's a wall of separation between church and state." Now that phrase, for 150 years, had been understood to be that the government would not interfere in church business, would not do what the Anglican Church did, where the king would interfere and say, "Look, you have to believe this, or you're put in prison. You have to be taxed to support this church." And so the Jefferson wrote back to them, realizing that he had no power in Connecticut, but just encouraging them. And for 150 years, his phrase "separation of church and state" was understood that it was to keep the federal government out of the church business. I use the example of a restaurant business. Many states had their own monopoly restaurant chains, allegorically speaking. The only thing they could all agree on was they didn't want the federal government to establish a restaurant chain or regulate the restaurant business of the state. So that was what the First Amendment was. Now, two days after Jefferson wrote the letter to the Danbury Baptists, he attended church in the U.S. Capitol. and heard Baptist preacher John Leland speak. Yes, they had church in the U.S. Capitol all the way until after the Civil War. Washington, D.C. was a planned community. So they built the government buildings first, and then the neighborhoods and churches. And so the government buildings were built. That's where they had church. John Quincy Adams went there, the first black preacher, the first woman preacher, the first Catholic bishop. They all stopped in the U.S. Capitol for Sunday morning service. And that's where Jefferson attended just 2 days after he wrote the letter to the Danbury Baptist.
I want you to get your telephone number, I want you to get your website, your email, or whatever you'd like to put up.
My website is AmericanMinute.com. That's AmericanMinute.com. And I have a toll-free telephone number. It's 1-888-USA-WORD.
AmericanMinute.org.
AmericanMinute.com.
We'll be back just to wrap up the program in just a moment or two. Well, we only about 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
All right. Start now?
Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought it was interesting. Jefferson extended 3 times an act of Congress which set aside lands for the use of Moravians for the purpose of civilizing the Indians and promoting Christianity. Jefferson signed a treaty in 1802 with the Kaskaskia Indian tribe, which included support of $100 a year for a missionary and $300 to erect a church. To trust men was simply to keep the federal government out of state government's business, and religion was so important to the states they wanted to keep the nation, but the federal government could do what it wanted in the federal territories. And so here's Jefferson in the federal territories supporting missionaries out of the federal budget. Jefferson proposed a plan of education for Washington, D.C., and had the Bible as one of the textbooks to be used in education. Jefferson signed the Articles of War, which earnestly recommended all officers and soldiers attend divine services. So I think it's important to realize that he went through this evolution from an Anglican and then helping these Baptist and Methodist churches. Then his wife died, and he went over to France when they were into their Unitarian thing, came back and got enamored with that for a while and vacillated. And toward the end of his life, when he had this correspondence with Adams, he comes back to faith in God. And he definitely speaks very highly of doctrine. He is always attends church somewhere, always faithful in his church attendance. Was he an evangelical? No. Was he born again? Probably not, but who knows the heart of man. But we do know from his writings that he was very supportive of the Judeo-Christian worldview.
Time realized that you had to have some sort of a guide for humanity. You didn't have, something, a social anarchy, which of course is what we've done.
In the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., there are 5 quotations, 4 on the plaques and 1 around the ceiling. 4 of the 5 mention God. And in 1, Jefferson said, "A God who gave us life gave us liberty. Can't be secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be removed but from his wrath. Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever."
And that is certainly one of my favorite quotations from Thomas Jefferson. Thank you so very much for being with us, and I'm going to tell our listeners when we get back, how they can get copies of your book and your DVD or your CD on America's God and Country.
Thanks, Dr. Sam.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we hope that many of you will want to get Bill's book. It's called America's God and Country. It's over 800 pages, and it's an encyclopedic source of information on the Christian faith of most of our founding fathers. That's America's God and Country, and you can get that along with a CD, which has a lot more information on it, or you can simply get the book by itself and get the CD later. We carry Tim LaHaye's book, The Faith of Our Founding Fathers. That's Faith of Our Founding Fathers. We have John Salfont's book, Abandonment Theology. That's Abandonment Theology. And certainly one of our favorites is Original Intent by David Barton. He does an excellent job with that. Original Intent, if you really want to understand what the Founding Fathers believed. We carry the book Betrayed by the Bench, written by my good friend John Stormer, goes into the background of what the Supreme Court has done to our nation. We have The Supremacist, written by Phyllis Schlafly. All of these books go into how the people on the Supreme Court had a different agenda. There were people who don't want one nation under God. In fact, they don't want one nation. They want, of course, to destroy the sovereignty of our nation and merge us into a world government. And let's get rid of Christian Brotherhood of Darkness. So if you'd like to get to any of the things we've talked about, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We hope many of you will go to our webpage at www.radioliberty.com and look at the various items we carry there. We do carry the Berkey products, and if you want to get the fluoride out of your water, and you really should, while you're searching, want to get a Berkey, a Big Berkey, or a Berkey Light, and of course, if you'd like to send me the Miracle Soap products, but one thing we've started carrying are certainly health products, and you need to be taking vitamin C and vitamin D and supplements. You need to be taking selenium and magnesium and probably coenzyme Q10 and all of these things, and we offer them at comparable prices from really the leading manufacturer in the nation, but they're under our own brand. You're going to have, well, we're going to have RL products, Radio Liberty products, but you'll not get them any better any other place, and we hope that you'll lay in a supply. We're moving into very difficult times, and you want to have a supply of these things on hand to maintain your health before the what lies ahead. So if you'd like more information on the product we have, or you'd like to get a copy of our health products that we carry, and certainly we carry magnesium, and if you don't know it, you are magnesium. You need to get the wonderful book,